This podcast is for general informational purposes only and not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. The medical contents and information provided are solely the opinion of the guest speaker. Lung and Learn. Interesting topics about all things respiratory.
Welcome to this edition of Lung and Learn. I'm your host, Dr. Anna Spearin. Day to day, I talk to physicians about current respiratory publications and their impact on clinical practice. Today, I'm here with Dr. Ronald Grossman from Credit Valley Hospital in Mississauga. Dr. Grossman is a wealth of knowledge, and he's here today to discuss some staggering statistics on pneumonia. But first, Dr. Grossman, let's hear a little bit about how you ended up as one of the key experts in the field. You really do have quite the story.
Well, as I'm sure you're aware, most things in medicine don't happen on purpose. They happen by chance more than anything.
It always seems to be that way, for sure.
So just to go back, in 1983, I was approached by the head of the lung transplant program in Toronto, which was in its nascent phase, and I was assigned the task to identify patients who would be candidates. So the first successful ever single lung transplant was my patient who had pulmonary fibrosis.
That's great.
And the first successful ever double lung transplant happened to be my patient, someone who had alpha-1 antitrypsin emphysema. And both of them were successes, and that was the beginning of that program.
That's phenomenal.
So for the next 4 or 5 years, I was involved with the lung transplant program. And then in the late 1980s, the person who was the head of our intensive care unit became chair of the Department of Medicine and left our hospital. And since I was trained in critical care, I was more or less obliged to take over the ICU as a co-director. So when I became co-director of the ICU at Sinai, before I knew it, I was doing a lot of clinical trials and antibiotics. And because you're sort of at the cutting edge and these are all new, I became more or less an expert on antibiotics. And that translates, of course, into pneumonia.
Okay.
Exacerbations of COPD. So from that expertise, I was well known to the infectious disease community. So that's how I kind of transitioned. It was an opportunity, things happened, and the rest is more or less history.
Talk about a transition. You had quite a journey. So to jump right in, I was hoping we could start by discussing some of the most recent data on pneumonia. And just to remind our listeners, in 2016, Statistics Canada actually stated that influenza and pneumonia was the 8th leading cause of death in Canada. So we're interested to hear from you, Dr. Grossman, and your perspective on pneumonia and its link to hospitalizations, cardiovascular disease, and mortality.
So pneumonia obviously is still an important process with a lot of morbidity and mortality. In Canada, we have very recent data, actually just from a year ago, that if you are admitted to hospital with pneumonia, the in-hospital mortality rate is 11%. That's more or less 1 in 10 will die if you get admitted to hospital.
Wow.
If you end up in the ICU with your pneumonia, it's about a 1 in 3 chance of dying.
Oh, I didn't even realize that.
So pneumonia continues to be an important disorder with significant morbidity and mortality. And the ones who come into hospital are a fraction of the entire population. Now, there's no question that those people treated in the outpatient setting, their mortality rate is less than 1%. They do reasonably well. But the ones who get hospitalized have a problem, particularly if you're over the age of 50. And what's really coming out and is very interesting is the why are they dying?
So why are these patients dying?
So they don't come in and die necessarily of overwhelming infection and sepsis, although a small percentage do. The fact of the matter is that there is a very significant cardiovascular signal that crops up with pneumonia. Pneumonia is a very powerful inflammatory signal to the body. And several things have been identified. First and foremost, this powerful inflammatory signal probably destabilizes plaque and coronary arteries.
Right.
So there's about a 5 or 6% chance of having an acute myocardial infarction in conjunction with your pneumonia if you're over the age of 50 and are admitted to hospital.
Okay. So in addition to those destabilized plaques, what's the second thing?
The second thing we know is that this acute inflammation associated with pneumonia does very bad things for platelets. There's an enormous amount of sticking of platelets, which is another one of the factors that may lead to a cardiovascular complication like an MI.
So we have destabilized plaques, sticky platelets. What else?
And the third thing we've learned is with the pneumococcus is that it itself can kill cardiac muscle. A direct attack on cardiac muscle and will necrose cardiac muscle.
Okay.
So there's good animal models to show that if you have bacteremia with pneumococcal organisms in animal models, it's associated with progressive rises in cardiac troponin. And if you look at cardiac muscle in these animal models, the cardiac muscle dies. And if you think it's just an animal model, you're incorrect because it's been translated into humans as well. So there are multiple mechanisms that these organisms can cause grief. And so cardiac complications associated with pneumonia are really quite profound. So 5 or 6% chance of a myocardial infarction, something like 10 to 20% chance of worsening congestive heart failure, and about a 10 or so percent chance of developing atrial fibrillation. So cardiac arrhythmias, heart failure, myocardial infarctions, all associated with acute pneumonia, particularly pneumococcal pneumonia.
Wow, right. So now that we know that pneumonia not only affects the lungs, how can we potentially mitigate all these nasty effects? Do you have any advice for how to minimize patient risk of community-acquired pneumonia or any lung infection for that matter?
Don't get pneumonia. So how do you don't get pneumonia is really what the question is.
So then what would you do?
So with pneumococcal pneumonia, we have some options now to try and prevent the disease. So let me just go back one step to talk about how you actually acquire pneumococcal pneumonia.
Okay.
So the pneumococcus is a very unique organism. There is only one reservoir for this organism. It's in the nasal pharynx of little kids. It is not in the water. It's not in the furniture. It's not in the bathrooms. It's not in fomites. It's in the nasopharynx of little children.
Got it. Nasopharynx, little children.
Little children love to share secretions amongst themselves, amongst their parents, and amongst their grandparents. So if your young child is in a daycare center, the chances are if there's one child that has a pneumococcus in their nasopharynx, many of the kids in the daycare center will have pneumococcus.
Oh.
Then when the child is picked up by the parent and they share their secretions, the parent may transiently become colonized with the pneumococcus from their child.
Mm-hmm.
Now, parents, generally speaking, are at the prime of their health. The problem is the grandparent.
Oh, shoot. I see where this is going.
The grandparent, his immune system is not what it was when they were 25 or 30 years old. So they have waning of their immune system and they're the target of the child's pneumococcus.
Right, right.
So if you look at who is likely to succumb to pneumococcal pneumonia, it's a U-shaped curve. It's the little infant who hasn't developed an immune system and the elderly who have a waning immune system.
That makes sense.
So that's the pathogenesis. And the solution is to vaccinate the grandparent.
Of course.
So we now have two vaccines to prevent pneumococcal pneumonia in the elderly. The one that's been around for a long time is the 23-valent vaccine. In the various meta-analyses that have been made, it's pretty clear that it doesn't work. It does not reduce mortality, but it may reduce the likelihood of bacteremia by about 50%.
Hmm. Okay.
In contrast, the newer vaccine, the protein conjugate vaccine, has been demonstrated to reduce pneumococcal pneumonia by about 45% risk reduction.
Mm-hmm.
So we have evidence that the newer pneumococcal vaccine, the protein conjugate vaccine, is protective to some extent in people over the age of 65. So we strongly urge people over the age of 65 to have this new vaccine.
Absolutely. It's great to have something for this at-risk age group.
The problem is that pneumococcal pneumonia risk is driven not only by age, but by comorbidity. And the comorbidities that really drive that risk are COPD, asthma, cigarette smoking.
Oh.
Basically lung problems. Now, heart failure, diabetes, chronic renal failure, chronic liver disease play a role as well. But the lung diseases are really the one that drive the likelihood of pneumonia, particularly COPD.
And the inhaled corticosteroids they may be taking don't really help either. So what do the guidelines say for these patients?
So right now the guidelines say for a healthy 85-year-old, you should give the pneumococcal conjugate vaccine. But for a 58-year-old with bad COPD, they don't say a word.
Oh.
But the risk of pneumococcal pneumonia in the 58-year-old COPD patients is probably four times higher than the healthy 85-year-old.
Oh.
So there's this real disconnect between what the evidence would suggest and what the risks are and what the recommendations are.
So then what would you do?
So yes, we have an intervention that reduces the risk of at least pneumococcal pneumonia, but it's not perfect. For any of the other bacterial pathogens, we really don't have anything.
Hmm.
And on the viral side, we have influenza vaccine, which potentially is helpful in the years where the match is reasonable. But where the match is not reasonable, the vaccine probably doesn't do very much at all. So that's hit or miss. We clearly need better technology on the vaccine side for viruses, to be sure.
Right. Viruses just continue to seem very tricky. What about atypicals? Things like Legionnaire's disease or anything like that. Is it the same story?
So what we know about the atypicals is they continue to be important players in particularly community-acquired pneumonia in people who do not have to come into a hospital. So mycoplasma in some seasons may be as prevalent as the pneumococcus is causing disease. So ignoring it, I think, is wrong. We have antibiotics that clearly work for those pathogens.
Right.
And there's some recent recommendations that say for community-acquired pneumonia, you should only give beta-lactam and don't cover the atypicals. And I personally think that's really quite a mistake.
Right, right. Okay, so to summarize what we've just learned, pneumonia is clearly a big issue for our healthcare system. It's strongly associated to cardiovascular complications, nasopharynx, little children. And while there's a vaccine for pneumococcal pneumonia, it doesn't address things like viruses, and it's sometimes not offered to those at highest risk. So, as you say, just don't get pneumonia. What happens if you do get it? Are there any important clinical considerations? And what new data should healthcare providers be aware of?
Well, there's a couple of things that really are important. Number one, be sure of the diagnosis. That's not heart failure, pulmonary embolism, that sort of thing.
Of course.
And if you're assured of the diagnosis, there are certain risk factors that identify people who are potentially going to die of their disease. Remember, it's 12% hospitalized patients will die, 30% if they go to the ICU. And we can pretty well identify those people in advance. And then there are very good predictors, which I'll talk about in a second.
Mm-hmm.
And the other factor that is really important is to get the drug in early. So you got to choose, you have the right diagnosis in the right place with the right drug given quickly. Those are kind of the factors that really play a role.
That makes sense.
So how do we know who needs to be hospitalized and who can go home? We have tools that help identify patients at high risk.
So which one would you recommend?
The simplest one has been around for quite a long time. It was developed by the British Thoracic Society called CURB-65.
Right, right.
So it's five variables that, when taken together, tell you something about mortality. So CURBS, the C stands for recent onset of confusion. U stands for an elevated blood urea. R stands for an elevated respiratory rate greater than 30 breaths per minute. B stands for a lowered systolic or diastolic blood pressure, usually below 90. And 65 is age. So you have five variables. Each variable is 1 point.
And then you tally up the score.
So yes, if you have more than 1 point in any individual, the mortality risk is at least 10%, and they probably warrant hospitalization. So that's telling you something about severity of illness.
Right. So you can use the CURB-65 score to better triage your patients. So what other tools could you recommend?
There are a number of other biomarkers that tell you a lot about what's going to happen. For example, we don't think about it, but blood sugar tells you a lot. If someone has hypoglycemia with their admission to hospital, their mortality rate is doubled.
Right.
If they have either hypo or hypernatremia, again, risks go up. If they have hypo or hypercapnia, elevated or decreased CO2, their mortality risks go up. So there are a lot of these routine things that we measure that are actually quite predictive of poor outcomes in the more seriously ill patient. And the more of these, you know, outcomes that are abnormal on admission, the greater the likelihood this person is not going to survive their event.
So just paying attention to routine measures can go a long way.
So yes, but at the end of the day, once you've made the right decision to admit, then you make the decision, are they bad enough to go to the ICU or not? Then the next step, and then probably the most important step, is get the antibiotic right in the first go round. So the first empiric choice has to be right, but also how quickly you give it.
Right.
So you give the drug within 4 hours of a hospital admission. So that's door to needle time. You walk in the emergency department, there's a timestamp, and get the antibiotic within about 4 hours. There's about a 15% risk reduction in death.
Oh, wow. That's so important.
So it's a cheap and simple way of saving lives. Just get the right antibiotic in at the right time.
Well, yeah, when you put it like that, it's an easy way to reduce mortality. So taking all this into account, let's bring it back to the patient who has just been admitted with pneumonia. Could you tell us a little bit about prognostic indicators that might be important to consider?
So when people come into a hospital and you treat them, they should respond pretty quickly. Most of the important variables like blood pressure, heart rate, temperature, get better within 48 to 72 hours. So people stabilize within 48 to 72 hours.
Okay.
And if they're not stabilized within 48 to 72 hours, either you got the diagnosis wrong or you got the antibiotic wrong or something really dreadfully wrong with this patient, and you need to reassess.
Got it.
That's the time you would make an assessment about whether or not you need to change the antibiotics. Did you have it right in the first go around? And by the way, at 48 to 72 hours, you should be getting back information from the lab, whether it's a sputum culture or a blood culture or any of the other diagnostic things you may want to do, to give you some idea of what the approach might be in terms of changing antibiotic therapy.
Mm-hmm. Sensitivities are definitely important. But like you said earlier, the hope would be to get it right the first time around.
The other thing that seems to be important is admission to the ICU. A delayed admission to the ICU is a bad thing.
Right.
If someone comes in and they're really quite ill from the get-go, and you can use the CURB 65 or a PORT score to sort that out, an early admission to the ICU is much better than letting them fester on the ward for a couple of days, deteriorate, and then go to the ICU. The outcomes are always better if they're in the ICU early rather than late.
So definitely taking a proactive approach then. Dr. Grossman, you've given us so much to think about, all the way from data about pneumonia background, risk reduction, mortality. Is there anything else we haven't covered?
The other thing that's kind of interesting that people are talking about is in severe pneumonia, the role of corticosteroids.
Okay.
So there have been quite a number of trials looking at corticosteroids as adjuncts to appropriate antibiotic therapy, particularly in severe pneumonia, trying to see if it impacts on a reduction in mortality.
And does it?
There have been two large meta-analyses recently published. Both of them are borderline. There's a certain way of looking at the data that suggests there's a couple of outlier trials that drive a positive signal. So I'm not convinced that the steroids do anything. I think we need more data before we say anything definitive about that.
Well, on the positive side, there's now some room to do more research on corticosteroids and pneumonia. That could be a whole other podcast. So for now, we'll wrap up this incredible discussion on pneumonia. Dr. Grossman, this has been very informative. Thank you so much for your detailed insights.
My pleasure.
If you found this episode about pneumonia interesting, you might consider listening to our other Lung and Learn podcasts, which cover topics such as dyspnea and COPD. Until next time, thanks for listening.